It's season 2, episode 8 of the Doctors and Litigation podcast. I'm Gita Pensa. Welcome back. Phew, here I am just sneaking this podcast in under the wire. It is almost October, but it's technically still September. And I know I promise one of these every month for a while, and I am keeping my promise. I have just been really, really busy this month. Obviously, clinical work, but also just a ton of coaching and consulting, a couple of trips to different institutions to do litigation-specific peer support development. I just got back from Chicago, where I did the keynote for the American Bar Association's healthcare law section. It has just been a super fun and busy month. But today on the podcast, we are going to talk about juries. One of the things that doctors who wind up in the litigation process are totally mystified by is that all of a sudden, the medical facts of a case and whether what you did was reasonable can be completely trumped by optics. Optics? Like optics in whose eyes? Well, we mean optics in the eyes of a hypothetical jury. And if you are a physician or other clinician who winds up as a defendant on trial, as much as you might be worried about your own performance and your own testimony, as you should prepare. But what might be one of the most pivotal moments in your trial will actually be jury selection. In my own two trials, if you recall, I have been a defendant on trial twice in the same case, but in my own trials, I thought jury selection was actually one of the most interesting and surreal experiences I have ever sat through in my life. Like watching my attorney go through so many internal deliberations with his co-counsel and asking questions of prospective jurors super strategically, trying to decide who to strike, and realizing that so much of my fate rested on who wound up in that box. I'd never really thought about it before that point. And so this hypothetical jury finally becomes real flesh and blood people at trial. But so many decisions made up to that point, both by your defense counsel and the plaintiff's attorney, will all be about how will the hypothetical jury perceive the story that our side is telling? How will the hypothetical jury perceive the story the other side is telling? How will they perceive the plaintiff, the defendant, the experts? And these are all guesses. There are going to be guesses about who these people might be based on the venue or where the trial is taking place and what the socioeconomic demographics are. There will be decisions about settlement or moving forward towards trial, decisions made around what the jury will think, and we don't even know who is on the jury yet. Now, if you haven't listened to season one, I want you to start there and definitely listen to the one on trial and settlement before you continue with this one. But in this episode, I am talking to trial consultant Shari Bellitz. Shari is CEO and owner of Shari Bellitz Communications. She's a trial consultant and works on litigation strategy for high exposure cases in civil defense work. We are going to talk about why the jury is all important in this process, how a trial consultant strategizes around jury selection, questioning strategies during the voir dire, how attorneys need to think about striking jurors for cause and exposing bias or using their precious peremptory challenges. We're going to talk about mock trials and focus groups and what these things can and cannot do and how we should and should not be using the information that we get out of them. And basically, I'm going to be picking this expert's brain so that you have a better understanding of jury selection and the importance of it in this process. Shari, thank you so much for coming to talk to everyone today about what you do as a trial consultant and things that we should know about the jury in a medical malpractice case.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I think that a good place for us to start would be talking about what it's like being a trial consultant, what it is that you do, how you assist. I think you only work defense side in civil cases, it sounds like. Also, I don't think you only do medical malpractice. You do the whole gamut of civil litigation. So tell us a little bit about what you do as a trial consultant.
Sure. So, Gita, let me first give you a little bit of background to kind of get your audience acclimated to what I do, which is basically the marriage of psychology and law, two subjects that I am passionate about. So I was a practicing attorney for 20 plus years. And I took a leap of faith at some point and went back to school for studying forensic psychology, which is a type of legal psychology. It really encompasses everything from hostage negotiation, mental health, law enforcement, like FBI profiling, and of course, trial consulting. And that's what I always had my eye on. I went back a little bit later in my career to study forensic psychology, and I really just wanted to dive into human behavior and decision-making, group dynamics, things that I've always been fascinated with in the legal system. That's how I became a trial consultant. The civil defense side was sort of a natural fit for me. I had been a civil defense attorney. I had been in-house at an insurance company dealing with large catastrophic cases. And that's the route that I took. These are my clients now.
Thinking about the jury, I mean, all the things that you just listed there, group dynamics and things like that. I think as a physician who was entering the arena of medical malpractice, I had never had a single thought about the psychology of juries, and thinking about the psychology of juries would influence what happened in my case and in the ways that everybody but me thought about the case in terms of, you know, how the attorney thought about the case and how the plaintiff's attorney thought about the case and how the insurer thought about the case. Like, I thought about the case in terms of what did I do? What did I not do? Was it medically correct? And it turns out that nobody else thinks along those lines, which was a shock to me.
That's actually an excellent point, because if you think about it, not litigation, but just in life, we're always thinking through our eyes, through our lens, like from our perspective. But when you're at a jury trial, it's not about what the lawyer thinks, what the litigants think, what the witnesses think. It's really you are putting on a show for your decision makers, which is the jury in this case, the civil jury. So you really have to kind of flip things around and think about them through their perspective. There may be a great point that your lawyer wins on the law or objection sustained, or there's a really great legal ruling by the judge. Often, as far as juror perception, that doesn't mean anything to a bunch of lay jurors who are deciding your case. So it's really important to look at things through the lens of that audience, as we would do if we were doing a show or if we were doing a sales pitch or whatever we're doing, looking at things through the lens of who you have to persuade.
So the jury is an abstract idea until you actually get to jury selection, is what it seems like. And since the jury is the absolute decision maker in these cases, and we need to be thinking about the perspective of the jury as we communicate, first, let's talk about the importance of jury selection and how every step of the way, the question is just like, how is the jury going to see this? How is the jury going to see this? It matters who is on the jury. So tell me more about how is the process of jury selection accomplished? And I assume it varies from state to state. And how are you working with your attorneys to influence that process the best you can in your favor?
So that's a really interesting question. And jury selection is a fascinating process. And one of the things that makes it so fascinating is that there's probably no other court procedure which varies as much from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, from courtroom to courtroom, than jury selection. For example, I just worked on a case where we received the names of the entire jury pool 2 weeks in advance of jury selection. There was so much time to prepare. However, that's just the anomaly. Often we receive the names in real time. We meet the jurors in real time. Sometimes there's questionnaires. Sometimes there are not questionnaires. I've selected juries where there are 30 minutes of questions and the judge sticks to that. And sometimes jury selection's a lot looser and it's taken me 3 days to select a jury in some jurisdictions. So especially if you work nationwide, as I do, as most jury consultants or trial consultants do, it's really important to know what you're dealing with as far as when do you get the names? how many people are seated in that courtroom? Will you get questionnaires? Can you write the questionnaires? How long will you get? Like, you really need to know the playing field before you play, so to speak. So that's an interesting question because it varies so much depending upon where you are.
Okay, so that's different from what I experienced in my trial. I don't think that the jury had questionnaires, certainly not that they were filling out ahead of time. And in that circumstance, they had a pool of people who were sitting in the room. They called up a number. That person went up, and then the attorney started asking them questions. And I believe this is called the voir dire. Tell us more about the voir dire and what attorneys are trying to accomplish in the voir dire.
Okay, so attorney-led voir dire is the attorney's chance to question prospective jurors or veneer persons and to weed out the jurors who are going to be biased towards their clients. So it is really the only opportunity they're going to get to really listen to what these prospective jurors are saying and to make quick decisions. These are very quick decisions that have to be made as to whether they're going to be a detrimental juror for the case. You usually don't question someone thinking, are they going to be a good juror? I think they're going to be a good juror. No, you're looking to weed out the really dangerous jurors for your case. So that is the purpose of voir dire.
Now, you can't ask anything point blank. Well, I guess you could sort of get to the point. Like when you're saying a detrimental juror in a case that involves medical malpractice, who are you trying to weed out? Someone who overtly hates the healthcare system? What kind of questions are going to get you there?
It's really going to depend. Everything is such a case-by-case analysis, which is why, and there are still people and clients who will call me right before and say, I have a jury selection starting Monday. Can you do it? Can you be there? And sure, I can do that, but you're not really getting the strategy. You're not really getting the full utility if you do that. What you need to do is I need to look at that file beforehand. I tear that file up and see what the issues are, because you could have two medical malpractice cases. You could have someone who's a great juror for one of them, but be a terrible juror for another one based on their attitudes toward a specific issue. So really the best way to begin your strategic voir dire is to take that file, tear apart that file, start writing down the issues. And from those issues, you're going to develop who is your ideal juror, who is your worst juror. Most of the time, it's going to be something in between. But then you're going to start to write your questions based on that analysis that you do to weed out the attitudes that are going to point you to those detrimental jurors. So it's a real case-by-case analysis.
And I think there's a lot more to it. I was very naive when I went in and I was sitting with my lawyer and they were doing the voir dire and asking all sorts of questions. And they were ranging from, you know, where do you get your news and what do you do for work? And it strikes me that they're working off of a lot of stereotypes. I mean, how else are you going to get at asking the question without really asking the question? You can't ask them to prejudge the case. You can't tell them what the case is about yet. But you want to kind of guess, like, what would this type of person think about this story that we're creating about what happened in this case? And so it feels hard because it seems like the name of the game is figuring out the stereotype and then letting that idea run out to, you know, what is this person going to decide about this? And it made me wonder a lot about bias in this, because I know that one of the primary considerations my attorney had in thinking about, like, how do I present myself? How do I talk to the jury? Was, you're a woman physician. He never really came out and said, you're a brown woman physician, but like maybe that was in there somewhere too. He thought that a predominantly male jury would be a favorable jury for me, depending on who those people were. Like that, I mean, there were a number of considerations. I think he was very good at what he did, but I had no idea the degree of like how much they would sweat out the questioning of every single juror. What do you advise people in cases where there may be some inherent bias against the defendant if the defendant is a woman, if the defendant is someone of another race, if a defendant has a non-mainstream appearance. How do you think about these things?
I always say voir dire is, there's nothing secretive about it. There's really nothing so magical about it, which is why I don't like those questions that go to stereotypes, like those old school questions, where do you get your news? Unless the case is about news, you can extrapolate 100 things from where someone gets their news. Maybe I get my news from the New York Times. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean that I buy into the political ideology? Does it mean I like the crossword puzzle? Does it mean that I maybe like the real estate section on the weekend? You have no idea what that means. So I like to get to the heart of the issues of the case. And if there are going to be stereotypes about whether it's a witness, whether it's a defendant, whether it's the plaintiff, just go ahead and ask the question. I believe there are no real coded questions to ask, like those news questions or what's on your bumper sticker. I don't like those questions because then you're just making inferences, often wrong, often based on stereotypes. Just go ahead and ask the actual question. If the issue is PTSD, for example, as damages, ask a bunch of questions about the juror attitudes about PTSD. If the defendant is perhaps a different race than maybe many of the jurors are in that jurisdiction, go ahead and ask if there's judgments. Like, you're not going to uncover any probably really covert biases, but you will elicit some responses that may knock some biased jurors, biased against your client, off the jury. So my mantra is really, you have to be very directed when you ask questions. Like, nothing is a code for anything else. Like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they're not codes for thinking that someone holds a certain attitude. If you want to know what attitude they hold, just ask them. And those attitudes are going to go to the issues of the case. Sometimes they'll go to a witness or a specific thing that you brought up as far as, okay, you're a woman of color, doctor. You can ask those questions to the jurors, or to the prospective jurors. You're going to get a lot further than if you ask them those coded questions about, well, what do you read and what's the last book that you read and where do you get your news and things like that.
So can you just ask them, like, do you have beef with women doctors?
Absolutely.
You could just like come out and say, like, do you like women doctors?
You can absolutely. I wouldn't ask it as a close-ended question. I would ask it as an open-ended question. I like to ask jurors questions about experience. How many people here have had a woman doctor as their primary care physician? And then get a bunch of people to raise their hands, and you're going to get maybe half of the people seated in the box to raise their hands. And then, okay, prospective juror number 3, what are your thoughts about that? And just pose it as a really open-ended question and get them talking. And maybe their thoughts would be something like, well, you know, I feel a lot more comfortable because I'm a woman and I can talk to them about issues that they understand firsthand. Or maybe you're going to get someone who says, you know what, I think it's great that there's women physicians, but I personally like to go to a man because I think they're more straightforward and I can trust them more. Okay, why do you think they're more straightforward and can trust them more? And start to just sort of dig into the attitudes. And someone who says that may not be biased per se. Maybe they're more comfortable with a male physician for their own reasons, but harbor absolutely no bias against a female physician generally. So you really have to, voir dire is your time to really get the jurors talking.
So I think you started to paint a nice picture for someone who's never been in a courtroom, who's never been privy to watching jury selection. I actually thought it was fascinating. If it wasn't about me, I would have been really just so interested because the questions, like they start to get personal, and these people, like you find out what they do for a living and you find out how they spend their days. And it was very, very interesting. And so getting into the psychology of it, when you're talking about group dynamics, these are people who are answering questions in front of other people. It's not like in a questionnaire where they get to sort of keep their answers to themselves. Like all the other people in the jury box who are in the moment with them don't really know them. And so they're probably thinking about their answers and how are these answers going to be received? And some of them have the bias of, I don't want to be on this jury, so maybe I will let my bias fly. I just can't say how interesting it is. It's so interesting. I'm sure that you as a psychologist find this completely fascinating. And then as an attorney using that, help people sort of strategize around who do you want to be in that box. Now, how does an attorney get a juror on or off? Heather, you've got this box of potentials. Then you ask a bunch of questions and each side gets to do their own engineering here. So how does that happen?
So there are two types of strikes, which is the mechanism to send a juror home sweet home, as I like to say. One type of strike is a strike for cause, and that is a reason you have unlimited strikes for cause. Both sides have unlimited strikes for cause. And that is when a juror articulates a reason where they cannot be fair, or they may harbor some bias or some type of reason that they cannot serve that really goes to the heart of the issues. This isn't, well, I have an appointment to do this. That's something else completely. That's a hardship where the judge makes that decision. But these cause strikes are really what you want to build up on either side when you have jurors who are undesirable to you. You want to prove that for cause, they are going to be biased or they are not going to be fair. So you have unlimited cause strikes.
The cause is really in the eyes of the judge, though. You're going to say, I want to strike this juror for cause, and the judge has to agree.
Correct. The judge makes the final decision. Then you have peremptory challenges, and those are limited, and you want to save them. That is where you can strike a juror just based on your hunch, based on, I don't like this juror, based on, I just want to get this juror off my jury. However, there are limits to that. For example, there's a whole line of cases where you can't make strikes, peremptory strikes, based on race, based on various protected classes, but you can make them for really arbitrary reasons. You don't like the way that they looked at you, or they made a face, or you just have a bad feeling about them. So putting race, putting gender, putting protected classes aside, you get a limited number of peremptory challenges. So what you really want to do is you want to build cases for cause strikes. And if you have jurors who look like they're going to be really great, you want to make sure you inoculate them against getting cause strikes from the other side. So to give you an example, if you have someone, I just finished a sexual abuse trial, and there was a juror who I just knew would be biased because this is a sensitive subject matter. So these jurors really had to be questioned quite thoroughly about their attitudes. And there was just something that made me think she would be biased against my client. The best way to initiate your cause strike is to start asking them a lot of open-ended questions and get them talking. Get them talking, and they are going to, if they are biased, they are going to mention their bias. And this one mentioned her bias. And when we went to do our round of cause strikes, you know, you take good notes on this and you present it to the judge. Well, she said X, Y, and Z. We believe that she cannot be fair. And the other side, if they want her, they're going to argue against you. So flipping that, if there are jurors that you really like, and if you have questionnaires, sometimes you can already tell who you're going to really like. Like, I will tell you a bias that I have, and this is a stereotype that's perfectly okay to have. And I probably go into every trial with this, every civil trial. I really like small business owners and I really like accountants. I'm not saying I'm going to like every one of them, but most of the time, those end up being my MVPs. A lot of times the accountant ends up being the foreperson. If I see questionnaires with someone who owns a business, someone who's an accountant, on my last jury, I had an accountant who owned her own small business. And I'm like, okay, she's the MVP. So the beauty of being on the defense side, and there's a lot of things really difficult about being on the defense side, but the beauty about being on the defense side is the plaintiff's attorney is going to question first. And the plaintiff's attorney is going to question the jurors that they do not like extensively. So the plaintiff will have done their job and questioned who I perceive to be my good jurors, those accountants and small business owners that I'm going to love for my damages portion of the trial. And they're going to question them. So often I will say to my attorney, once I see that they're good jurors, they've proved it by answering the plaintiff's questions, I'm going to say, okay, ignore them. You need to ignore them. We are going to hide them. We need to save these valuable jurors. And then you can even take that a step further and you can ask them some closed leading questions. This is the only time I recommend closed leading questions about being fair and being impartial. That will inoculate them against a cause strike. Like, let's say you have that accountant who you know is going to be great and frugal and looking at every line on that life care plan. Ask the accountant if they could be fair and impartial. They tell you yes. Okay, get the heck out of there and then start questioning your bad jurors. And now when plaintiff goes to make a cause strike, well, she said she could be fair and impartial. Cause strike denied. Make them use their peremptory challenges to get rid of your good jurors. So it's a game of chess.
I hope people are really getting the idea that this is a game of chess because there's so much strategy involved on so many levels that we are completely oblivious to. We just want to think that this is about the medicine and what we did and what we didn't do and that we're just blind to the way the rest of the system works. And, you know, how much can rely on how the attorney asks the questions, who's on the jury, even what jurisdiction is the jury pool coming from? That I know in the very beginning of my case, certainly because of where different parties were geographically, they were pushing really hard to try to get the jury pool in one jurisdiction versus another because of what they knew statistically about income in a certain jury level, education level in a certain jury pool. It was nothing I'd ever thought about before.
Absolutely. There are so many considerations to take into account. And what I like to say, and this is like probably very appropriate timing to say it because I'm in New York. We just had a verdict in the Donald Trump trial. So a lot of people are thinking and talking about verdicts and juries and jury selection and things like that. It's so rare that you get a change of venue. I know that they wanted a change of venue. In the Trump trial, it's so rare that you can get a change of venue. It's a better strategy to figure out what you are working with and how to work with that. And one example I like to use, especially in med mal trials, are I've seen some lawyers get very nervous if they have a very complicated med mal trial or really a very complicated anything trial. But let's take med mal, for example. Let's say there's a very complicated trial involving a surgery gone wrong, and the lawyers will get nervous if they don't have a sophisticated, educated jury. And you know what? You're not going to get a sophisticated, educated jury everywhere, but you have to look at the cards that you're dealt and do the best that you can. So let's take, for example, a surgery. So to understand a lot of complicated things, a lot of expert testimony that's going to come in when you're talking about a surgery that went wrong, so you don't have an educated jury pool, but let's say you have a lot of people who are skilled tradespeople who may be in that jury veneer. Those can be excellent jurors because that's very transferable to understand something about a surgery using tools, using like spatial intelligence, things like that. Someone who does skilled trades work might be better understanding that than someone with a higher education who doesn't do work with their hands? Think about it. Surgery and skilled trades, same thing, working with your hands. So you have to look for these transferable concepts and not get caught up in, oh, this is not an educated jury. You look for what you can do with who you have. I'm not saying don't make change of venue motions. Of course, you want to do that if there's pretrial publicity or something like that. Of course, the Trump team wanted to do that, but you have to ultimately work with what you may have to work with and, you know, think of out of the box ways to do it. So that's an example I always use with surgery and skilled tradespeople.
That's a really great example. And one of the things that I do when I work with the physician defendants is on basically the strategic communication of knowing who your jury is and thinking about how to speak in analogies or whatever ways that you're going to teach the jury about what it is that you're doing, but in a way that they can easily comprehend. You're not talking down to people. You're just using the language that would be familiar to them and using analogies and metaphors that would actually resonate with them. So it's one thing to also to know your jury and to get as positive a jury as possible. But for the physician defendant, when it's time to testify, you should be paying attention to who is on the jury and thinking about ways to communicate strategically with them so that they can really understand with clarity the points that you're trying to get across.
That is excellent advice. And an example that I use about that actually involves doctors is with lawyers, with doctors, there are certain terms of art and we don't think anything of it. We're just using a term of art. And, you know, often our circles are, I have a lot of lawyers in my circle. You probably have a lot of doctors in your circle. And this is just sort of the way that you speak with your peers. So, for example, I was preparing a doctor for a deposition and he was talking about a woman who was pregnant. And he said, so she came in complaining that her water broke. And I was like, okay, wait a second. I know that it might be a medical term of art to say, just like it's a legal term of art, plaintiff complains that. But to lay people, they're going to hear like complains, like, what do you mean a pregnant woman complains? And they're going to start like throwing eggs or something at this doctor, because how does that look? A male doctor is talking about a female soon to be mom who complains that her water broke. Like, it's one word that really needs to be changed. But again, it's a completely normal word to use in a medical context, the legal context as well. It's little things like that. So to your point, yes, you have to know who you're talking to. And the jury, they're certainly not experts in whatever the case is about. And you have to talk to them like they are lay people and, you know, use the proper terminology.
Again, fascinating. Okay. Another thing I know you do for cases are focus groups and mock trials. You know, who are those for? What does that help with? Is that to see how they respond to the defendant? Is that to decide, oh, I feel like nobody in this mock trial was going to go for a defense verdict. Maybe we should settle. How do you use those?
That's a great question, because mock trials are so fascinating and really multifaceted in what they can do. But we also have to remember what they can't do. The misconception is that they are mini trials that make predictions, which they are absolutely not. They're not a large enough sample size to really get a statistical response. What they can do, however, is you can present your case, and the biggest utility for me is they give me themes. You get those themes right from the mock jurors. You'll either get them from the data that you look at after, or you will get it straight from their mouths, which is called the qualitative data. And you'll see what resonates. Like, what do they think of this case as a whole? You'll also get little bits and pieces, especially if you show deposition clips or something like that. Do they like this witness? Do they think this witness is credible? Do they trust them? Do they dislike them? Why? And really, with the decision making, and that is what it is, it's a study in decision making, you're getting to see the why behind the decision making. So I always tell my counsel, do not get married to that number. They may come up with a plaintiff verdict for $50 million, or they may come up with a defense verdict. It is the why they came up with that verdict. What pieces of evidence were significant? Which witnesses were credible and believable? What made them make these decisions? And that's really the beauty of the mock trial, the themes, the understanding behind the decision making, not that reductive, this is worth this much money. You're not there for the evaluation. You're there for sort of that background reasoning.
And for the defendant, I think it feels like a high stakes practice. It feels very challenging. I didn't have a mock trial. I had a mock deposition, and I didn't have a mock trial when I was preparing, but I've been involved in cases in which there are mock trials. And it's very interesting from the physician's perspective or the defendant's perspective, because it's a really great practice run, but it matters a whole lot, I think, what the defendant is told about the outcome of that mock trial. You know, in some cases, the physicians have gotten to hear the interrogation or whatever you call it of the jury afterwards, the mock jury, and they say things that they could be hurtful or they could be confidence shattering or they could just be about why they didn't like the doctor. And in some cases, it's really not helpful to their psyche as they're trying to prepare to go forward and actually do the real thing and perform with confidence. And in other cases, you know, if they're going to have a slam dunk, then, you know, that feels great. And then that can propel them to giving great testimony. But I mean, how do you advise people to manage that in terms of sort of insulating their defendant if there's bad news? Like, how do you get them into a growth mindset about that of like, okay, like that tactic didn't work. How do I change my messaging so that like my truth comes through and that the jury understands my truth as opposed to being like, I stink at this. I can't do it.
The first thing is I generally don't have clients watching the mock trials. Like I wouldn't have, if you were the defendant in a mock trial, it would be your counsel. You wouldn't necessarily be there for all of those reasons that you just discussed, and you'd kind of get the high level after. So let's say that they played a video recorded deposition, and let's say the jurors did not like you. What your lawyer should be telling you, instead of shattering your confidence and saying, okay, they didn't like you, they should be telling you the constructive criticism, such as, when you spoke about X, they didn't understand what you were saying because some of the words were too complicated and it made you look like you were throwing big words at them, for example, or they didn't like how you didn't take responsibility for X, Y, and Z right away. You were beating around the bush. So they can give you constructive criticism about aspects, but they shouldn't say something like the jury hated you, because you're going to take that to the witness stand. You should be able to have some concrete takeaways to work on rather than anything like just overly critical for no point. Like everything that they tell you should have some type of constructive aspect to it.
I think the take-home point I want for people to have is that, again, hammering the point home over and over and over again, there is a lot more that goes into this than you think. And if you come into it with this attitude of, I'm just going to tell the medical version of the events, I'm just not going to learn the craft of doing this well, you may not get the outcome that you're hoping for, because those aren't the rules of the system in which you're working. And it behooves you to learn how the culture works, learn how the system works, so that you can put your best foot forward. And I think just having an understanding of all of the variables that go into these cases, because obviously when a case doesn't go your way, it's heartbreaking. And there are a lot of reasons, because these cases are so optics matter, optics matter, optics matter. And sometimes the optics just aren't good and people have to make decisions about your case that you might not really agree with. But I think really coming to terms with this being about so many other things besides just you is important.
Absolutely. It's always hard to put our egos aside. And I'm just fresh off a victorious trial.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Everybody is so concerned with their own personal silo. And And whether it's a litigant, whether it's the lawyers, whether it's the consultant, like you're so concerned with your silo, you have to be willing to have that trust that the other professionals who are doing their jobs really know what they're doing. Like I was preparing a witness to testify and I was giving him some pointers about body language and just, you know, the way that he conveyed his story. And I think maybe it didn't feel natural to him. You know, this isn't the way he would have said something, but there were reasons that I was doing it. And those reasons were to advance one of our themes. So not that someone should feel uncomfortable speaking in a way that they're not accustomed to speaking, but I was really trying to get him to open up and tell his personal story because it was a compelling story. And I knew it would be a compelling story for the jury to hear about his background. And maybe he wasn't comfortable talking about his background, but I was doing it because it was advancing one of the themes. So I like to explain why I'm doing what I'm doing, and it makes things go a lot more smoothly.
So Sherry, I'm going to end things now, but I will say that I'm just going to ask, like, will you come back? There's so much to unpack. I want to ask you so many other questions.
You know, I'll come back because there's so much I want to say, not just now, but always. I'm very passionate about this craft. I study it. I come back from trials and I always say I've learned something new and I want to apply it next time and I'll research and I'll write about it. So yes, I will come back, absolutely, and we'll talk part two because I'm sure there's a lot of ground we can still cover.
There's a lot of ground still to cover, and I really appreciate your coming because it's just, you know, it's all so foreign to us that having your perspective is really, really valuable. And so when you come back, I'm going to ask you lots of stuff about how a physician defendant wants to show up and some of your tips about that. So thank you so much, and we'll have you back. All right, everybody, thanks so much for listening. That's a wrap, and I will see you next month. Until then, take good care.